Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Government 101, where when we talk about a president's Myers-Briggs result, there's decades of theories behind it. I'm Taylor Tambernino, a political science student here at MNSU, and I'm joined today by Dr. Fred Slocum, an associate professor of political science here at MNSU who teaches both the class on the U.S. presidency and political psychology. And I'm happy he's here, because with the Biden presidency ending, the Trump presidency resuming, and the Carter presidency being remembered after his passing, there has been all sorts of discussion over how to assess a president's time in office. Today, we'll go over a few different models and metrics that political scientists use to assess presidents to hopefully give you the tools to make those sorts of assessments for yourself. So thank you for being here, Dr. Slocum.
Thank you for having me.
I brought up the Myers-Briggs results a little bit earlier, but similar to those, while these are qualitative assessments, there's not one that is distinctly better than another. So these are not really ways to decide who was better, Millard Fillmore or William Henry Harrison, but more how to see similarities and differences between Fillmore and Harrison's time in office.
Yes.
The first sort of categorization for presidents I wanted to talk about is Barber's typology of presidential character. Can you talk to me a little bit more about what that is and how it's used?
Yes, this is a classification system devised by James David Barber, who is a presidential scholar. He devised a system of classifying presidents based on two variables. One, whether they feel positive or negative about the job of being president. And second, their activity level, whether they are active and actively pursue the powers of the presidency and be hands-on, or passive, those who tend to be reactive and wait for leadership or initiative from Congress in their presidential actions and decisions. Mm-hmm. So based on that, Barber classified presidents into one of four categories. Active positive, those presidents who are active in their orientation towards the job of the presidency and who actively enjoy the work of being president, the different hats or roles that presidents fill. That's one. And examples of active positive presidents include Franklin D. Roosevelt, John F. Kennedy, Bill Clinton, and to a large degree, George W. Bush. Then we have active negative presidents. These presidents actively seek out the power and maximally use the power of the presidency, but their feelings towards the job are generally negative. And examples of these kinds of presidents who are fairly compulsive in nature include Richard Nixon and Lyndon B. Johnson. A third classification or third category is passive positive. And these are presidents who are passive in terms of how actively they seek out the responsibilities of the office, but feel positively about the work of being president. And Ronald Reagan is a typical passive positive president. There are not many other examples. And then finally, passive negative presidents are low in activity level and feel negatively about the job of being president. Calvin Coolidge and Dwight D. Eisenhower are cited as examples of passive negative presidents.
One thing I found fascinating about Barber's classifications was how he was able to put each of the four first presidents of this country into different categorizations. I said earlier that these are not qualitative judgments, and while passive negative may seem to be the worst of the four, the father of our nation, George Washington, is commonly cited to be a passive negative president, and that was perfect for the start of our nation. He let things develop as they otherwise would in the first 8 years and was willing to step down after two terms because he was passive and he felt kind of negatively about the office. Adams is commonly seen as active negative, Jefferson's seen as active positive, and James Madison is seen as passive positive. It's interesting how we got the representation of the four types basically immediately. The next way that presidents can be classified is by how they manage the White House. White House management will usually come in one of two major models, either a wheel style or a pyramid style.
Yes, the wheel or spokes of the wheel style is a model of presidential management where the president sits at the center of a circle of advisors. And there is not much hierarchy in this style. The advisors surround the president in all directions, but there's not a lot of hierarchy or levels of authority in this style. A lot of advisors typically have access to the president with this style, and it tends to foster open communications and tends to be best for presidents who prefer to be hands-on. Presidents who actively make decisions themselves rather than delegate decision-making to others will often prefer the wheel style of management. The wheel style tends to be preferred by Democratic presidents to a greater degree than Republican presidents who prefer more hierarchy, and presidents coming from legislative backgrounds, not having executive roles in large organizations. Presidents who are examples of the wheel style would include Jimmy Carter. Bill Clinton, during his first 2 years, had a rather chaotic wheel style of management, which migrated more towards the pyramid style later. And John F. Kennedy. All of these presidents welcomed advice from multiple advisors and did not institute a lot of hierarchy into the structure of their White House. The second style is called the pyramid style. This is more hierarchical. The president has access to fewer individuals. In the purest version of the pyramid style, the president appoints a strong chief of staff, a single individual who filters communications and decisions that might come the president's way. And then below the chief of staff, there are several levels in the hierarchy, and aides at the different levels each filter information and decisions coming from lower levels and decide which are important for them to hear and which are important to pass up the hierarchy to the president. The chief of staff exercises that role at the end. And so the president has limited access to a large number of people. In fact, it may be informed only by the chief of staff and a small circle of aides. There are more layers of hierarchy with this style, and the information flow that comes the president's way tends to be less. This style tends to be preferred historically by Republican presidents and by presidents who have come from executive backgrounds in large organizations, for example, being governorships of large states or the military. So examples would be Ronald Reagan, who previously, prior to becoming president, was governor of California, although albeit back in the 60s. He also had been a spokesman for General Electric and worked in the corporate world as well as a Hollywood actor. Reagan did not come from a legislative background, which tends to predispose presidents towards the wheel style. George W. Bush also was a strong pyramid style president. He had previously served as governor of Texas, and he had worked in corporate environments, including partial ownership of the Texas Rangers baseball team, and he had worked in the oil and gas industry as well. So with his background in corporate settings and as a governor of a large state, Bush was naturally predisposed to be a pyramid style president. The danger with the pyramid style is that the president can become disconnected from reality. The information flow coming to the president can become so restricted that the president does not have awareness of what's going on in his own White House. The danger for the wheel style is that the president can become overloaded. There's little hierarchy with the wheel style, and the president may become bombarded with information and has a greater risk of basically paralysis by analysis. Too many decisions may be forwarded to the president. Some decisions might best be delegated and taken on by the president's aides instead. And so the risk for the wheel style is that the president will become overwhelmed and overworked.
One more recent development is a third style called the ad hoc style, in which you are forming committees, you are making special advisory boards and task forces for specific issues. So you will make a committee to specifically handle one specific area of the economy, and then they will report to you everything that they find. This is sort of reminiscent to modern CEOs, and Clinton in the second half of his presidency, Bush Jr. and Donald Trump all use this style.
If you're just joining us, this is Government 101. I'm joined today by Dr. Fred Slocum to discuss different ways that we categorize presidents.
For the final categorization that we're going to go over today, we have the high, medium, or low opportunity, popularized by William Lammers.
William Lammers and Michael Genovese, two political scientists. Lammers is deceased, but Genovese is still alive and an active presidential scholar. This classification by Lammers and Genovese classifies presidents as having high opportunity, medium opportunity, or low opportunity to influence the general policy and political direction of the country. There are multiple factors involved in assessing opportunity levels, but one of the biggest ones is the partisan and ideological makeup of Congress. Some presidents are majority party presidents, like, for example, Trump is now, where his party holds majority in both chambers of Congress, so the Republicans hold a trifecta in the national government. That is a factor leading presidents to be higher opportunity by nature because they face less constraints from Congress. And Trump also has a friendly Supreme Court now as well. So Trump certainly starts this term as a higher opportunity president because the partisan makeup of the Supreme Court has shifted rightward compared to Trump's first term, which was beginning in 2017. A quintessential high opportunity president was Franklin D. Roosevelt. He began his term in March 1933 at a time of wartime crisis, the Great Depression. The Democrats had gained enormous ground in Congress in the 1932 election as well as the 1930 midterm election before, when Democrats gained a House majority. And 1932, Democrats gained the Senate majority as well as the White House. And so Democrats had a trifecta in 1933. The country was facing an existential economic crisis in the form of the Great Depression, with unemployment reaching 25% that year, bank holidays causing bank closures and panics in terms of depositors making runs on the banks to try to withdraw their deposits in case the banks went under. farmers in crisis in much of the South and the West, a great pent-up sense of change was really afoot in 1933. So Roosevelt had a friendly Democratic majority to work with, a sense of almost wartime crisis with conditions of the Great Depression, and a strong public demand for change in policy direction. Other high opportunity presidents more recently, Ronald Reagan was a high opportunity president in 1980. His party had won the White House and 12 Senate seats in the 1980 election, which is an enormous number for a single election cycle. Republicans also gained ground in the U.S. House, and they fell short of a majority in the U.S. House after the 1980 election, but having gained 34 seats. So the Democrats had taken an enormous electoral beating across the board, which enhanced Reagan's opportunity level to begin with. Despite the Democrats maintaining a House majority, the Reagan White House was able to basically steamroll its entire budgetary package, consisting of cuts to social programs, increases in defense spending and tax cuts and deregulation through Congress, notwithstanding the Democratic House majority. Many Democrats broke with their party's leadership in 1981 and helped Republicans pass the Reagan budget package in the House of Representatives, notwithstanding Democrats still holding a slimmed down majority in that chamber. Medium opportunity presidents would include presidents like Barack Obama, who started his presidency with Democratic control in both chambers, who, however, lost a majority in the House of Representatives in 2010 and lost their majority in the Senate in 2014. Obama's presidency ended with Republican control in both chambers of Congress. The same was true for Bill Clinton's presidency. Bill Clinton had Democratic majorities the first 2 years of his 8 years in office, and then faced Republican majorities the remainder of his time in office, which sharply constrained Clinton's opportunity level. Finally, some presidents have relatively middling opportunity levels. Richard Nixon is one of those. He won a narrow initial election and a landslide reelection, but Democrats controlled both chambers of Congress throughout Nixon's presidency, which limited his ability to influence policy on the domestic side to a considerable degree. And Nixon embraced some progressive initiatives, such as, for example, creation of the Environmental Protection Agency by executive order in 1970. Based on a number of factors, the partisan and ideological makeup of Congress, the presence or absence of a crisis situation, to what extent there is pent-up public demand demanding a change in policy direction, the presence or absence of foreign contextual events like wars or military actions overseas. Wars overseas tend to constrain presidents' ability to influence domestic policy and also constrain the budgets available for domestic policy initiatives. And presidents' approval ratings, their initial approval ratings, especially to start with during the first 100 days, approval ratings typically decline after the first few months in office. Very popular presidents tend to have higher opportunity levels, at least to start. And since most presidents' approval ratings decrease across the course of their presidency and tend to be lower in the second term than the first term, presidents' opportunity level generally tends to be lower in a second term than a first term for two-term presidents.
Going back a bit to Nixon's more middling power, after the Watergate scandal broke and Nixon resigned, Gerald Ford came in and had probably some of the least opportunity of any recent president we have seen, just because, one, he wasn't elected. He succeeded in the presidency. And after he pardoned Nixon, he had extremely low popularity both in the public and in Congress, so he was basically unable to do anything.
Yes, Ford was largely a caretaker president, and it is true that when he made the decision to pardon Nixon, it really degraded his popular approval and made it much more difficult for him to get traction in Congress, which, you know, still was controlled by Democrats in both chambers at the time. So Ford was a minority party president from the beginning.
One thing that Lambers brings up that I found very interesting is how much opportunity is lost just by being in your second term and why he posits that might be. He says first-term presidents have a lot of momentum because usually they will campaign on an issue or some initiatives that they want to take care of. But largely, incumbent presidents will campaign on 4 more years or keep the president in power and will not have specific initiatives to go into their presidency with, and thus will have less momentum and power to get those initiatives that they might want passed.
Several factors also in second-term presidencies. First off, second-term presidents at the start of their second term usually are less popular than they were at the beginning of their first term. Secondly, the midterm elections tend to degrade a second-term president's party strength in Congress. In other words, the president's party usually loses seats in Congress in midterm elections, both for first and second-term presidents. And finally, second-term presidents often find themselves embroiled in scandal during their second terms. Ronald Reagan had the Iran-Contra affair in his second term. Richard Nixon had Watergate in his second term. George W. Bush had, wouldn't call it a scandal, but a continuing war in Iraq, basically constantly dragging down his approval rating. And there was a controversy over the firing of U.S. attorneys also during the Bush presidency. Obama stands out as a two-term president, really, who did not experience a major scandal during his years in office. But second-term presidents often face scandal and sharply declining approval ratings. So those are some of the factors going into presidential opportunity level: high, medium, or low.
Then I think those are the three categorizations we wanted to go over today.
I hope that you learned something today, and we'll keep these in mind when thinking about presidents' time in office in the future. I want to thank Dr. Fred Slocum for joining us today. Government 101 is a production of the Minnesota State University Mankato Political Science Department and the Politics and Policy Student Organization. Any views expressed in this program are solely those of the host and the guests, and do not necessarily represent the views of Minnesota State Mankato or any affiliated parties. If you have any ideas for the podcast or are interested in being a part of it, reach out to us at politicsandpolicy@mnsu.edu. Again, that email is politicsandpolicy@mnsu.edu. A huge thank you to the MSU Mankato Colleges of Humanities and Social Sciences for the use of our space and equipment. Another large thank you to Caden Rademacher for composing our theme song. And thank you all for showing up to class.